This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode about grief. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. So far, the world has lost more than 6 million people to COVID-19, and many families affected by those losses were not able to say goodbye to their loved ones. Researchers have learned that how a loved one died and how we get to say goodbye or not has a major impact on grief. Liz Tong has this story on what the pandemic has taught us about grieving.
Bob Niemeyer's long journey with grief started when he was just a kid.
When I was 12 years old, not quite 12, about 10 days short of my birthday, my dad died by suicide.
It was something his mother never really recovered from. And as he got older, Bob wanted to try and understand grief. He became a clinical psychologist, professor, and researcher, and he spent the last 40 plus years studying grief and the therapy techniques that can help treat it. So when the pandemic hit, Bob knew we were heading into a storm with a very long tail.
We recognized this is going to be a tidal wave, that we really have what I came to call a shadow pandemic of grief.
Bob and psychologist Sherman Lee developed what they called the pandemic grief scale to identify cases of dysfunctional grief associated with deaths that took place during COVID-19. Dysfunctional, meaning it impairs someone's ability to work, take care of children, maintain relationships, live their lives. Bob gave a rundown of some of the symptoms.
Wishing that they were dead so they could be with their loved one again. Finding it impossible to care about much of anything because of this loss. Finding any positive and consoling memories of the loved one to be completely inaccessible because it was so overshadowed by the trauma of the loss, increased risk of suicide, of substance abuse and dependency.
Bob and his co-author surveyed more than 800 Americans who lost loved ones during the pandemic, whether from COVID or some other cause. And what they found was that two-thirds of respondents were suffering from dysfunctional grief, what they called pandemic grief, which led to their next question.
What makes these COVID losses so difficult?
To find out, they looked at the context of the deaths that led to the most extreme symptoms. And they found that a lot of those factors were related to one thing, being separated from their loved one, losing their chance to say goodbye.
Not being able to be there with the loved one at the end of their life, feeling a kind of emotional distance from them when the only medium of contact was an iPad or a tablet. Anger at the physicians and medical staff for not keeping the family engaged with the patient's condition and care during a time when, of course, the medical world was overwhelmed by the number of people being admitted to hospitals.
They missed the chance not only to say goodbye, but to care for and help usher their loved ones into death, to sit by their bedside holding their hand, to leaf through photo albums and talk about old memories, to brush their hair or paint their nails or give them a final shave, even with chaplains and nurses who volunteered to help families say goodbye over iPhones or tablets, it just wasn't the same.
These intimate moments of bonding and expression sometimes of gratitude, of love, but also sometimes expression of forgiveness or the asking of forgiveness, have a deep meaning and purpose for people. And when they are denied those opportunities, what we find is that complications do arise. And this is very clear in our research on death in the pandemic era.
The forced separation, the distance, it affected grief even with people whose loved ones didn't die from COVID.
And what we found was that the cause of death didn't matter. It was the complications and the circumstances of dying that predicted the outcomes.
It's almost as if pandemic grief was a whole new genre of grief. See, typically with so-called natural deaths, deaths resulting from age or illness, grief is less complicated, if no less painful. And technically, dying of COVID is categorized as a natural death. But the grief Bob was seeing looked more like something else, grief resulting from sudden, violent deaths. It shared a lot of the same characteristics.
First of all, a sense of shock and horror. Many of the symptoms that they struggled with, like these images of their loved ones struggling for life on some machine in isolation, then there's the comparable sense of sort of helplessness, in the same way that we're kind of astonished by it. There's nothing we can do. And the same occurs in the context of violent death bereavement.
There's also anger, limitations in social support, unanswerable why questions, feelings of guilt, and more. Other researchers have also documented the traumatizing effects of COVID losses. One Chinese study found prolonged grief in nearly 40% of bereaved people, more than triple the usual rate. So how do we help people who are going through this? There isn't yet a guide for dealing with pandemic grief, but there is guidance on dealing with grief resulting from sudden or violent death. For example, a book by psychotherapist Kathleen O'Hara called A Grief Like No Other.
Certainly any death is tragic, but when you don't get to say goodbye, you don't get to say anything, it leaves you completely on the other side of the grief because there's no preparation.
Kathleen has firsthand experience with sudden violent death. 23 years ago, her college-age son, Aaron, was kidnapped and shot to death. She told me about the moment she got the news.
And I remember holding the phone, and you know that when people say their blood runs cold, that's what it felt like. I was swirling into disbelief, like this cannot be happening. So there's a shock quality to it. When something shocking happens, we have a whole system physiologically and mentally and emotionally that protects us from the thing itself.
Kathleen says shock is partly a defense mechanism, something that helps us stay standing at a moment when our sense of reality has crumbled. It's knowing something terrible is true and yet not fully believing it at the same time.
I knew it in my heart. I just knew that he died. I remember being in the funeral home, and of course, I never got to see him. So the casket was there, and I remember thinking, well, maybe he's not in there. I mean, these crazy things that you think in grief, your mind is not exactly functioning.
A lot of that shock and trauma comes not only from the sudden, unexpected nature of violent deaths, but the fact that loved ones don't get a chance to say goodbye.
You know, there's something in all of our human rituals that help us, and we hope the other person. Because imagine the other person dying, we don't know what they were feeling at the last moments. We can't ask them. We can't see it. This is all unsettled and unfinished. So there is no closure other than the death itself. And we are left to try to figure that out somehow. There's something about the disbelief because your reality changes in the moment of that realization. So how can the mind accommodate that?
Bob Niemeyer says accommodating that new reality is what grief is. It's not just a feeling of sadness and loss. It's a process of reckoning with and rebuilding our shattered reality.
The question is, how do we live with it? Do we hold the grief or does the grief hold us? Do we find meaning in the life that we have? Can we experience moments of joy and gratitude? Or are we just simply swallowed up in bitterness and darkness and refusal of the tragic beauty of this world?
5 years after her son died, Kathleen started writing her book. In it, she includes the lessons she learned from her own grieving process and that of her clients. She talks about grief as an ocean, one that can drown you if you don't find a way to survive, and dealing with it as a process of getting back to shore. One of the first things you have to do, she says, is learn how to float. Find the qualities within yourself that can help you manage your grief, like courage, hope, faith, spirituality, and optimism.
You know, I call them life preservers, because we're in the ocean of grief, and we're going to drown. And we need to find things within ourselves. And these are all human qualities that can help us not only survive, but ultimately live again.
Next, Kathleen says, you have to find your lighthouses in the harbor, family and friends who can give you guidance and support. Once you're not actively drowning, one of the hardest parts begins, learning how to ride the waves of grief, overwhelming feelings of sadness, anger, and hopelessness. Once you learn to ride those waves of grief, Kathleen says, you get carried out to the middle of that ocean of grief.
So I call that out in the deep, right? And one of the things that will help us get from the deep back to shore. And those are things like gratitude and forgiveness and you know, how we're going to come to terms with this grief and the depth of the feelings and the experience.
Finding your way out of that ocean involves transmuting your despair into something productive, taking ownership of your story and the grief within it, and turning it into something creative. Art, writing, music, a foundation, something that honors the one you lost. Eventually, Kathleen says, you'll be able to come out of the ocean and swim to shore, or she calls it the new world, where you once again start thinking about the future.
How we're going to live again. How we're going to face this new world without the ones we love.
I asked Kathleen what helped her the most in the first 5 years after her son's death. She said one big thing was facing her feelings.
I think because I was a therapist and I was already familiar with several people close to me dying, is that I knew how to deal with feelings. I was completely unprepared, by the way, for the depth of those feelings. But I knew that if you can feel them and deal with them, you will heal from them. But it's the running away from them that causes the problems, because we're so scared of the feelings because they're so overwhelming.
She says some of those feelings never go away. And the goal isn't to make them go away. It's to transform how you live with your grief. And importantly, for people who lose loved ones in sudden and traumatic ways, that means getting over the initial shock and horror.
So, for example, this happened 23 years ago. I don't think of the event that the circumstances of his death. Thankfully, I've worked through that. What hasn't changed is the missing him. You know, he'd be 44 now. You know, what would he be like? So it's more of the pure just longing or missing for the person. That will stay. It doesn't have to immobilize you, but it certainly becomes that. And I think in terms of grief, that's a good outcome. That's a good outcome. I think that person stays in your heart and you have a different kind of relationship with them. And there's always a place in your heart for them.
Bob Niemeyer agrees with Kathleen.
I think maybe the goal is not so much to say goodbye, but in the words of a famous social worker, Michael White, to say hello again. How do we continue the conversation? How do we not so much seek to finish business, but to continue it with the loved one, but in a healthy way?
Bob offered some of his own suggestions. Rituals, like setting a place at the table for your deceased loved one, writing them letters, and maybe even answering them, taking long walks and having talks with them in your head.
And when we find ways of somehow taking in and making a place for this sad, sometimes tragic event that happened, becomes part of our life story, it becomes a tellable tale, we move beyond our own isolation in the loss, it's never too late to memorialize our loved ones. Just because we missed the obvious opportunity doesn't mean we can't invent another.
Write that letter. Take that walk in nature and talk to that person and say goodbye. You can do that. It's obviously not what we want, but we also have to realize we have to work with what we have.
That story was reported by Liz Tong.